Welcome to the new State of the Bay. I'm Ethan Elkind.
I'm Joseph Pache.
And I'm Grace Wan. This is your weekly conversation about where we live.
And what matters most. We are live.
And we are local.
Every Monday night.
Right here on KALW.
On tonight's show, we'll do a deep dive into pandemic learning loss with Heather Huff of Policy Analysis for California Education and Lakeisha Young of the Oakland Reach. Then we'll hear a conversation our co-host, Joseph Pache, had with Dr. Linda Hsu about her new book, Spicebox Kitchen.
But first, let's check in on the state of school reopenings with San Francisco Chronicle education reporter Jill Tucker.
It has been a very long year for parents of school-aged children in the Bay Area. Since schools closed last March, distance learning has been the only option for most public school students.
But parents may finally be seeing the light at the end of the tunnel. Bay Area schools, including those in San Francisco and Oakland, which we'll talk about, have recently adopted plans to gradually bring students back to campus. So here tonight to give us the lay of the school reopening landscape is Jill Tucker, education reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle. Welcome back to State of the Bay, Jill.
Hi, it's great to see you.
We are so happy to be talking to you because you seem to know everything about everything regarding schools. and I want to get into the school reopenings, but let's start with the many controversies swirling around the San Francisco School Board, particularly the latest with the vice president. I think that's Allison Collins. A slew of officials are demanding that she resign because of tweets she wrote in 2016 about Asian Americans. What exactly did she do and where is that controversy now?
Yeah, so these tweets, which again were from 2016, about 2 years before she was elected to office, are racist, anti-Asian tweets that have a variety of comments in the string of tweets that she put, and ever since they resurfaced, and were promoted by a group that are critics of the school board and are looking to recall board members. You know, it sort of has exploded over the last few days. This was on Friday when they came out. And since then, over the weekend, we've seen sort of an unprecedented number of public officials, including the mayor, including some supervisors and many others, calling for Collins' resignation. It's you know, these are people who don't agree on much, and yet, you know, they're sort of coming together to call for her resignation. It is not a unanimous call of resignation. There are three school board members, including the school board president, that are not supporting her resignation. You know, but we do have a split school board. Two members are asking her to resign. So it's a lot of chaos, a lot of controversy, a little scandal going on.
Yes.
Right in the middle of trying to reopen schools, you know, they're facing lawsuits, their superintendent resigned. There's a lot going on in San Francisco school district.
Well, and before we get into the details, do you think Collins is going to resign? Has she said what she's going to do?
So she responded to the questions about the tweets. She basically said that they were taken out of context, that she is sorry that she has caused people to hurt because of the tweets, but they remain, last I checked today, they remained online. So they're still there. She has not apologized for the tweets themselves, only for the impact that they've had.
Wow.
And Jill, if she did resign, what would that mean for the seat? Is there an appointee to that seat? Does it just stay vacant? What would happen?
No, so when there's a vacancy on the school board, and it's happened, you know, fairly recently with two current board members were appointed before they were actually elected because of open seats, the mayor appoints a replacement until the next election. So if she does resign, it would be filled.
Well, talking about an empty vacancy, we've got Vince Matthews, the superintendent, as you pointed out. He said he's going to resign at the end of this school year. Any word about how they're seeking a replacement? Or I think we know why he's resigning. Maybe the pandemic really broke him.
Yeah, he actually said in his resignation, you don't even have to I was going to say if you read between the lines, but I don't think you actually have to, that he feels that this board, there's only one school board member, Mark Sanchez, that was on the board when he was hired. This is a completely new board. And I think he, in his statement, said that he wants to give the board a chance to have someone that supports their vision. You know, so I think that there have been disagreements about some of the directions that the district has taken. And so he is stepping down. And we'll know a little bit more tomorrow about the process for a new superintendent. They're going to be talking about that process. So right now we don't have a lot of details, but I would assume they'll do a search, whether they appoint an interim, when Matthews leaves in June, we'll have to see.
Well, now let's talk about the school plan. When are kids in San Francisco getting back to school in the public school system?
So students are going to start going back in April. It's going to be the youngest kids first, and they'll phase in older students and students with special needs. There's the pre-K, preschool through two coming back first. Can I tell you how tired I am? I need more coffee because the date just escapes me. I apologize. April 16th. I apologize.
Yeah.
And then kids later on will come back. There's still no definitive plan for the older kids, for high school kids across all grades. They will be bringing the most at-risk kids, the kids with the highest needs, homeless kids, things like that. They're looking to bring them back. But it remains to be seen how many of the students will be back by the end of the school year.
Right. And so it's youngest first, special needs next, as they get older. We don't know if it's going to be 5 days or not, do we? Is it going to be every day?
It depends on the school is the original basic plan. Some schools will have to go hybrid, meaning kids will be part-time online and part-time in school. It depends really on how many kids want or how many families want to come back.
Mm.
So basically, if you have a classroom or a school where it's kind of split, where a lot of families want to remain in distance learning, the kids can come back full time because more time. But in general, what they're talking about is a hybrid schedule where the kids will be in the morning in person, and then the teachers will have the distance learning kids in the afternoon.
And are parents happy about the plan?
It depends on who you ask, of course. there's a lot of families that still would like to stay at distance learning, and I think that they're a little concerned about the amount of time that the students have with teachers. And then a lot of families are thrilled because they are desperate to have their kids back in school. There's a lot of kids that are really floundering, struggling with mental health issues. They miss their friends. They're totally checked out of school. They want to be back. And so I've heard from parents saying, I would take 15 minutes of in-person if that's all they offered. And then others want a full day again. They want them fully reopened. So, it really is a wide mix of what people are looking for. It depends on their circumstances. It depends in part on demographics. We know the pandemic has hit communities of color harder. And there's been some reticence. When you look at the surveys, Asian American families are least likely to want to come back. But in general, majority of each demographic is saying that they do want to come back.
Jill, I wanted to follow up with you on that. So, there has been a lot of widespread frustration. I mean, you mentioned that it depends on, demographic groups. Not everyone's fully on board, but the majority, as you say, have been in favor of getting their kids back in school. And we've seen New York City, for example, has basically had their public schools open, for most of the school year. So what do you think is the change now? And I guess, how would you explain the fact that it's taken this long when so much of the rest of the country has been able to figure out how to get kids safely back in school?
Well, it's a complicated question. I think it just depends a lot on each community. It depends on the teachers' unions. It depends on the leadership of the district. So you do have, in fact, Marin County, every single school is opened at least in part. High schools, middle schools, they've been open since September, many of the schools, and fully so. Middle schools, high schools. In fact, some of them are going back to full days for the kids and full classes, like in middle school. And then you have districts like Oakland and San Francisco and some others that have been a lot more reticent to go back. There's also issues of facilities. So, if you have old facilities, you have to fix windows, you have to sort of figure everything out. if that's going to take longer. But in San Francisco, there has been reticence among the union to go back, and they've been negotiating the conditions to return for months. And they recently reached a deal, and that's why we're seeing, you know, dates starting to come out about returns and something of a timeline, at least for some of the kids. But, you know, you see this across the region. You see private schools reopening. You see public schools reopening in some places. And I think that's been really frustrating, you know, for parents and folks in the community to see all, you know, they talk about how they you know, see they live near a private school and see the kids all there in the playground, and their kid is crying inside their house because they can't go to school and they're tired of Zoom. And, well, you know, it's devastating. It's tough.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, certainly a lot of parents frustrated if they're seeing exactly what you're describing, kids playing and their kids stuck at home on Zoom and, you know, hopefully learning something. But I know there have been a lot of challenges around that, which we're going to get to in our next segment. But we've talked a bit about the San Francisco plan for reopening, and I don't want to forget our other city across the bay. We are state of the bay. We're not just about San Francisco. We're about the whole region. And Oakland also just announced that they've reached a deal with their teachers union to get students back in school. So can you talk a little bit about what the Oakland school plan reopening looks like and when we can expect Oakland students to start returning to the classrooms?
Yes, I have to turn that door in my head and go to the other school district. So, but Oakland actually, they came to their deal. They pushed it through. They start going back at the end of this month on the 30th. So that is soon. And again, it's similar in terms of having the younger kids back first. But I will say Oakland has pushed farther in their deal than San Francisco. They are going to be having, by mid-April, they will have all of their elementary kids back, and they will have their special needs kids back, and they will have at least one grade in middle and high school. And that meets the state's guidelines for getting all that extra cash that the governor has promised. There's a $2 billion pot of money, and you have to meet certain reopening requirements to get that money. At this point, San Francisco will not meet that. But Oakland, their reopening plan aligns with that state, with those state guidelines, and they're giving teachers financial incentive to go back. So we will start seeing kids heading back to school in a little over a week, and then more kids heading back as we get into April.
And Jill, how do you explain the difference between Oakland and San Francisco in the sense that, as you just mentioned, Oakland is able to reopen on a more aggressive timeline and scale than San Francisco? What accounts for that difference?
You know, I don't know. There were a lot of discussions behind closed doors and the bargaining with the unions, and a lot of these conditions about who goes back and when and how, these all are negotiated with the unions, especially the teachers' union. I think the biggest difference that I am seeing between those two districts is the financial incentive that the district is giving the teachers. And it requires the district to meet the state guidelines in order for the teachers to get that money. So it looks like they sat down at the table, said, we all want this money. So they're giving all teachers that come back $2,000. If they come back by the end of March, which is sort of a voluntary period, they get an extra $800. So, you know, it's a $2,800 individual incentive for each teacher, you know, to reopen according to the guidelines of the state, which is a little more aggressive than what San Francisco did.
And do you have any stats? Are they keeping track of how many teachers have been vaccinated? Do either school districts in Oakland or San Francisco feel that their teachers are getting vaccinated?
From what I hear, they do have some tracking. Part of the problem is it's self-reported because obviously many teachers are getting it through their health plans or through, you know, they're making the appointments themselves, and it's tough to track. They do have the codes that they've been given to give them priority. But my understanding is, last I heard, a lot of the teachers had already gotten their first dose and we're on track to have many, many, if not a vast majority of the teachers vaccinated, especially those that will be going back first.
Is there any talk in either plans to extend the school year at all beyond the regular end date?
Yeah, you know, it's going to be, you know, education in California is very local, which is why you see all of these different reopening plans and dates. And that's going to apply to extending the school year, to summer school, or what happens in the fall. But with the caveat that there is a lot of money from the federal government and from the state to sort of for pandemic response for education. And that means there's going to be a lot of money for school districts to have some wiggle room and decide, you know, do they want to extend the school year? Do they want to do summer school? You know, do they want to hire more people for tutoring and mentoring? You know, how do they want to address the learning loss that you'll be talking about in a moment? You know, in terms of, you know, as they move forward, I will say, however, that extending the school year requires negotiating with the unions. The district can't unilaterally extend the school year. Summer school is independent of those contracts, so they can, you know, they have a lot more leeway of summer programs to address learning loss or to address other types of issues for the student. But extending the school year would actually require the agreement of the teachers.
And Jill, I also wanted to check in that we're talking about extending the school year, but what about students who potentially are moving on to private schools or dropping out of the schools altogether? I mean, this pandemic has definitely exposed and worsened a lot of the inequities in our society. And, you know, I'm hearing a lot about, you know, upper income families taking their kids into private school pods where they're hiring teachers or just leaving the public school system altogether. Are you seeing this happening? And do you think this might be a long-term phenomenon? If so.
Yeah, in fact, good timing for the question, because we got the numbers today on the applications submitted for school in San Francisco for the fall. And the numbers are down about 500 students from last year. And most of those are kindergarten. And, you know, you add to that the existing students who have left for private schools or who may not return in the fall. And, you know, we won't know the numbers really until the fall when kids come and enroll and show up. But the reality is the district looks like at this point, and this is the case in many districts, looks like that is losing a significant amount of enrollment, and long term that hits the pocketbook, right? Because they get money from the state for each student. Now they're being held harmless right now. The state isn't dinging them for enrollment losses because of the pandemic, but you know, they could potentially see very long-term consequences for this.
Jill, I also wanted to ask, we have a school board meeting tomorrow. It may get heated. So I wanted to ask about what issues might be coming up tomorrow. The public can attend. So any details that you have on that, we certainly air those meetings on KALW. They're on the second and fourth Tuesday of every month. But what do you expect to see happen, if anything, in terms of fireworks tomorrow?
Yeah, well, I'll be there. I think the word that I would use is it's probably going to be a little uncomfortable because you have a split board on the resignation of one of their own. And so I wonder what that's going to look like. I do think there's going to be a significant amount of public comment about it. How they handle this, what Commissioner Collins will say, you know, we'll see. I'll be there. I'll be covering it. And I think it's going to be a long night.
You are our intrepid education reporter. That is for sure, Jill.
Absolutely. Oh, well, Jill, we appreciate it. We hope we get you some caffeine. And we know you have a lot to cover. And tomorrow's a big day, I'm sure, with that meeting. But thank you so much. Jill Tucker, education reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And coming up next on State of the Bay, we'll have a conversation with Heather Huff of Policy Analysis for California Education and Lakeisha Young of the Oakland Reach about how the coronavirus pandemic has disrupted student learning in ways to help kids get back on track. We want to hear if your child has struggled, how you stay engaged, and what support you would like to see for students who have fallen behind. That's coming up next.
Yeah, and we want you to be part of the conversation. So give us a call with questions or comments at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or send us a message on Twitter at State of Bay. That's State of Bay, State of Bay, not State of the Bay. Earlier this hour, we had a great conversation with Jill Tucker about the return to in-person instruction in the Bay Area and across the state. With the California legislature providing financial incentives for school districts to return students to the classroom before the end of the school year, the prevailing notion is that distance learning has failed California students and resulted in harmful learning loss. As parents struggle to oversee the learning of younger children and high schoolers struggle to stay engaged on Zoom, a question looms. What will be the long-term impact of these months spent outside of a classroom? And as has been the case with other aspects of the pandemic, are the most vulnerable children suffering the most from this new model of schooling? Here tonight to discuss the latest research on learning loss and ways to combat it are Heather Huff, the Executive Director for Policy Analysis for California Education. Welcome, Heather.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
We're delighted that you're here. We also have Lakeisha Young. She's the co-founder and CEO of the Oakland Reach. Welcome, Lakeisha.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, we're psyched to hear from you. Heather, I wanted to start with you with just a very basic question. What is learning loss? How do you measure it?
It's a great question. Pretty much since schools closed in spring of 2020, researchers and policymakers have been concerned about the impact on kids. And essentially what learning loss and a big body of research at this point tries to measure is what have students not learned throughout the pandemic that they would have learned in a normal year, in a typical year? Can we quantify that? And can we use that information to try to start to build forward for how we recover and how we meet kids' needs? And so the way that most of the research studies do this is by using formative assessments, assessments that are administered throughout the school year, and comparing students' growth on this to this particular year, comparing their growth to how students grew in prior years. And essentially what the learning loss is the gap, the difference between what students learned this year and what students have learned in prior years.
Well, you're sticking with that thought. Back in January, your organization published a paper sharing early findings on student learning in grades 4 through 10 for 18 different California school districts. What did you guys look at and what did you find?
We looked at some of these formative assessments in, like you said, 18 school districts. And what we found is that in both English language arts and in mathematics for students in grades 4 through 10, students are between 5 and 25% behind in this year compared to what they were achieving in prior years. But what really concerned us in this research is the differences that we're starting to see by different groups of students. So for example, low-income students are falling behind much faster during the pandemic than students that are not low-income. And in some cases, we saw that higher income students were actually accelerating their learning. They were learning at a faster rate. So, for example, in grade 4 in English, that's producing a gap of 12%.
Wow.
So students that are low income are falling behind at a 12% of rate compared to before. We also found that English language learners, that students who are learning English actively, had a very strong impact. In grade 5, they were 30% behind a year of typical growth compared to only 10% behind for students that are not learning English. So why that really concerns those of us who work with this kind of data is that we already had very substantial gaps in learning for students in these groups. And what's happened during the pandemic is that it has exacerbated what was already an existing achievement gap.
And it would... Oh, go ahead, Ethan.
Well, Heather, I was just going to ask us a quick question on the details of the study. Were you controlling for students that were back in the classroom versus those that were distance full time or most of the time? Or was this just about distance learning?
We didn't have that student level information, but the data was from fall of 2020. And the vast majority of California school districts and students in California were in distance learning during that time. So that's a safe assumption, but we don't know how each student in that analysis was being educated during that time.
And Lakeisha, I want to bring you into this discussion. So first of all, I know you had some thoughts about the previous discussion about school reopening plans. So I just at the outset would just love to hear your take on the school reopening plans. And then I want to hear a bit about what your organization is doing to help kids in this distance learning environment.
Ethan, I appreciate that. Yeah, I do want to speak to the earlier segment because the information being shared about school reopenings is really not bringing in the voices of low-income Black and brown families, especially in Oakland. So even if I think about our families in the Oakland Reach, of which we're surveying right now, a majority of those families want to keep their kids at home this fall, okay? And they partly want to keep their kids at home because they have figured out keeping their kids at home is not only just logistically better, but they're finding that they're getting better programming and because they can also access our hub and our hub programming at home. So that's one. Two, if you look at the OUSD data, it's like 50-50 right now, right? With the majority of the numbers that you're seeing with higher, like 20% of family or 80 or 90% of families wanting to go back, those are particularly Hill schools. If you're looking at more of schools in the heartlands of Oakland, you are seeing a much bigger split that's more 50-50, right? And I believe that if parents had, if they knew they had a distance learning option that was high quality, that provided some socialization, you may see those numbers shift even more, right? Which I think brings us to the hub. Because what Heather is saying is true. I believe we've been in a perpetual learning loss for decades. So we can call this the pandemic learning loss, but we've just been in a learning loss, right? And so when COVID hit, that's why we jumped in quick. Like in March, we were starting to design our virtual family hub. So whereas our kids would have been in a learning loss in in-person learning, we have kids reading on grade level and above grade level because of what we've implemented. And we've only been able to do this because our babies are at home with their parents. So our families are actually more concerned about bringing our kids back into schools where we cannot determine the type of quality education they're going to get than what we can design, even with the school district, for our families with the kids at home. And again, the socialization piece is key, of which we are identifying and figuring out ways to do now. But we are on to something, and we are on to something really big. And I think we need to be really, really careful around conflating a school reopening conversation with the quality conversation. Because before pandemic hit, less than 30% of Black and brown kids were reading on grade level, right? And now that our parents got a hold of their kids' education, they're not really trying to give that up if they have other options that will keep their babies on track. So that's why we built that virtual family hub, right? And we built that hub. It has five really key components to that hub that really supports our families and keeping their babies on track to college, right? And so one aspect of that is really like high quality academic instruction. You know, we have been really pushing with our district and working with our district to implement the science of reading. There is a way to teach kids how to read. And it was hard to get that done, like collectively throughout our school district. So once we were able to build the hub and work with parents directly, we implemented the science of reading in the hub, and we had 60% of our K through two kids went up two or more reading levels, and 30% went up three or more reading levels. That's us taking over, us taking the science, not dealing with politics, not letting other people say what's right for our kids, but taking the science and what other states have adopted and actually doing that. That's number one, right? Number two, all of our families have a family liaison. They have someone that supports them, right, to navigate what's happening. And you need a family liaison, whether you're in person or you're remote, right? Well, but it's been especially important as families have been. Is it okay that I'm continuing?
Oh, we love it, Lakeisha. I'm just going to do a quick reset so people know what we're talking about. So we are talking to Lakeisha Young, the co-founder and CEO of the Oakland Reach. And we also have Heather Huff. She's the Executive Director for Policy Analysis for California Education, also known as PACE. We're here at State at the Bay, 91.7 KALW, local public radio. And we'd love to hear from you. Has your child struggled staying engaged these past months on online school? What have you seen? What have you done? done that has kept your child engaged, give us a call. Our number is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or find us on Twitter. We're at State of Bay. And Lakeisha, I just wanted to do just a quick recap because we heard a lot of stuff, which was amazing. But tell us again, what is the hub? Like, what are the ages of the kids in it? How do you get involved with that? Just a quick recap would be great.
Right. So we built the hub literally as a response to listening to our families at the beginning of the pandemic, right? Really saying that they were afraid. They wanted to make sure that their kids will still be on track to college. A lot of these kids are going to be the first generation college students, right? And so the hub is really an integration of both the academic and socioeconomic needs and aspirations of families, right? And we launched the first phase of the hub in the summer, and that hub was K-8, okay? And it was a full summer kind of program, which had the high quality instruction that happened Monday through Friday. It was sort of in the mornings, 3 hours. Kids had access to social enrichment. Kids, all families had access to what we call a family liaison, which has been key to our hub all throughout the school year, which I call them the educational social worker. This is the person that really helps their families navigate all of this. And like I said, this person is key whether you are navigating education at home.
I want one of those, Lakeisha. I want one of those.
Yes, everybody, you need to get you one, right? A family liaison. And they did everything. I mean, they helped families set up email. They also helped, like, attendance, like, do you need a phone call to help? Like, it's hard, but it was that support. We also, what's also key about what the hub does, the hub is also socioeconomic, right? You, what folks don't understand is that many of our families are really trying to figure out how to get this baby to college and also pay the light bill, right? That is a very extreme tension that our families have to figure out. We wanted to make sure that the hub, which our schools often don't do, right? That the hub was really thinking about the fact that these things need to be working together for our families to feel like they are set up for success. So what that has looked like in practice, in the summer, it looked like providing stipends for our families at the end of the summer hub, right? But what it's also looked like throughout the school year is we have something called the Family Sustainability Center. We call it the FSC. And that FSC is providing both academic and socioeconomic workshops. So for instance, we may have a whole workshop on literacy, but then we'll turn around and have a workshop on housing. We actually just launched a whole like opportunity fund for just our families so that they can go back to school and take classes and just really like, this is about how do our families thrive in the midst of this pandemic and not just survive, right?
I think
what
that's
can we do more for our families that we couldn't do, right? When we were in person learning.
That's
Sorry,
I mean, there's a lot of information to share, and it's great that there are passionate advocates like you and Heather working with our students to make that happen in what has been an incredibly tough year. Quick question before we jump back to Ethan is, how if I'm an Oakland parent, how do I get involved in the hub?
So if you want to learn more about the hub, just email us at hub@oaklandreach.org, and we'll take it from there.
Yeah.
But can I say this last thing, Grace?
Oh, you're still on. Yeah, go for it.
I just want to really just say that we are on to something. We have an opportunity to do something for the communities of families that we have just failed. And this is not a failure on their part. I want to note, our families are having their kids in school from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. just so that they can access our hub. So we are really trying to move to a model that is more parent-led and more centered. And the last part I'll say is that more privilege. We have given our families privilege. They have gotten porterhouse steaks during this whole pandemic when it comes to academic. And is anybody trying to give up a porterhouse steak? I don't know about you, but I'm not, right?
So I will take the steak.
Yes, so that they feel like that they deserve the best. I just wanted to add that.
All right. Well, Heather Huff, I wanted to go back to you. So this is not a question about porterhouse steaks, although that sounds like a great line of discussion for another time. But I wanted to ask about another research brief that you did looking at not just the academic performance of students during this pandemic, but their social and emotional well-being. And I think a lot of parents can relate to some of the challenges that kids are facing being isolated and on a computer screen all day. So can you talk a bit about that study and some of the recommendations that the report makes as a result of your findings?
One of the things that I think we always knew about what children needed to thrive in school is that, and what school is in our society, is it's not this unidimensional slice or vision of math and ELA. English language arts. It is how children are becoming in the world, how they relate to each other, how they're treated by people in positions of authority. And part of what we've seen during the pandemic is that that socialization, that belonging, the absence of that has led to very serious issues of mental health, feelings of isolation, feelings of anxiety. Some national studies have shown that suicidal ideation is up amongst adolescent children, that hospital admissions are up for mental health related crises. So for many students, that has been, and families, that has been catastrophic. And so one of the things we've been trying to raise during the pandemic is, as we're thinking about both the impact on students and the paths to recovery, we cannot have an isolated vision of what the impact has been. Because if we were to frame this as students' reading skills are down or students' math skills are down, then we might think, great, let's double down. Let's put them in school all day doing math. But that wouldn't be the right approach to meeting kids' needs, in large part because of what Lakeisha was saying. Students and families, their needs need to be centered. The schools need to serve families. They need to build from students' assets and really provide a place where students are engaged, where they belong, and where relationships are key. And there are many schools, I'd say the majority of schools in California, were not doing most of those things well prior to the pandemic, particularly for these students that we're most concerned about during the pandemic.
Well, so for those students who are struggling in that way, I mean, what specifically would you recommend that parents do, school districts do, what resources are available, or what more fundamentally needs to change to try to address? I mean, this seems like a really urgent crisis to address.
It is an urgent crisis, and there are things that need to happen now. But I think even more importantly, a lot of our work right now is trying to lay the groundwork for how school needs to be redesigned forever. So starting in fall, when we're reopened in a more typical fashion, and then into the future, we have a huge infusion of money from the federal government and state government. Combined, it's $35 billion to support California's schools. And this is an opportunity to correct things that have not been working well in our educational systems, ways that we have continued to exacerbate and reinforce inequality in our schools. And so the way to do this is, I think there's, you know, it's very multifaceted. Part of it, the biggest part of it, is centering students and families in the school design, talking with them. Every school should have a family liaison, like Lakeisha was describing. Every school should have a comprehensive team of mental health providers and nurses and social workers that are there to talk with students, to engage with them and their families, to help them when they're either in normal developmental, facing normal developmental challenges or mental health crises. It's also about, just once you talk with parents and you center parent and student needs, it's meeting those. What are they interested in? What kinds of clubs should exist to engage them? What kinds of personalized learning opportunities do they need? What kinds of project-based learning would help them to really be inspired to learn? And situating the students as the asset that we know they are.
Well, if you're just tuning in, this is State of the Bay, and we're talking about student learning loss and responses to pandemic distance learning. We're joined by Heather Huff of Policy Analysis for California Education, or PACE, and Lakeisha Young of the Oakland Reach. And we want to hear from you as well. Has your child been struggling to stay engaged during this period of Zoom education? What support did you want to see for your student or for the students in your community? We do want to hear from you. If you have a question or a comment for our guests here, the number to call is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also send us a message on Twitter at State of Bay. Well, Lakeisha Young, I wanted to go to you on this point that we were just discussing with Heather about the emotional impacts. And I'm curious, with your experience with the Hub, how has your program been addressing those? Have you seen any impacts? Are you doing anything sort of intentionally to address the not just the academic piece, but the social and emotional well-being of students?
Yeah, that actually goes with the five components of the hub. So, right. So I said one component was the high academic, high quality academic instruction. I talked about community, which is the family liaisons or FSC. But number three is actually social emotional support. Right. And you need it for the parents as well as the students. And I think part of that is the small class sizes that we do. You know, 25% of our families have kids with IEPs. So providing those sort of resources for them as well. We're now hosting like parent lounges for our families. Our families, our parents were like, look, we love being a part of this hub and it is really changing the game for our kids. And we're stressed out, right? This is a lot. And so they're like, can you help us create a space where we can just vent? So we did two things. We one, empowered their leadership to create those spaces and we supported it. So that's those things turn around right away. This is why it's important for parents to lead because the turnaround time is real quick than when you're waiting on it to happen from the system, right? And then the second thing we've done is we're bringing in mental health experts to actually provide through our Family Sustainability Center to provide more spaces and supports for our families around mental health. So we're doing this from, again, both the perspective of the student, but respecting the fact that the parent, you know, it's like in every other household, everybody respects the parent, but in low-income families and low-income households, the parents and the value of the parent is not looked at the same. If you want to see these parents, these kids succeed, you better put some investment into those families. So we really start with the mamas and the grandmamas because we know that they're going to uplift the whole household. So that's number three of like the five components of our hub that really focuses on the social emotional component.
Well, we have a comment from Dave in San Francisco. He writes, with some kids in class and some at home, how will that work? And Heather, what's going to happen? I mean, in the public schools, I mean, I think we're seeing some of this across the country and in some of the private schools that have opened. Some kids are in school. Some kids are still learning in Zoom. How has that been working?
Well, during the pandemic, while schools have been disrupted and enrollment has been disrupted, like Jill said, there's all kinds of different models that we see. So often the way that works is there's some kind of hybrid setting where there are cohorts of kids, some of whom are in class some days and then back online. We also know that if there is a cohort of kids that's fully online, the teacher is responsible for providing education both to those students at home and to students that are in class, which is a huge challenge for educators. So part of what we've heard is the way that educators are solving this problem is essentially by offering distance learning as their baseline. And then if students are in class, they're engaging with the material in class, but sometimes on their laptop or in-class opportunities are supplemental to the base curriculum. It's hard to overstate how challenging this has been for classroom teachers who have had to completely rework their curriculum several times in many places to meet the changing structural and ongoing needs of the pandemic. But this is why I think in the work that we're doing now and in the policy interventions and money that's been laid out, there's a lot of emphasis toward trying to think ahead a little bit, because this period where we're really on a week-to-week basis, trying to figure out how to best get kids in school, it will continue to be disruptive to student learning. And so we need to be acting right now to build toward that new normal.
Well, Lakeisha, I wanted to jump in with a question for you about the Oakland School District and how it's working with your project. So what kind of arrangement have you worked out, if any, with the school district, and how's that going, and how do you anticipate that to go?
Yes. So thank you, Ethan, for that question. We just received a large grant in December, right, to expand our hub within the Oakland Unified School District. We were building and running the hub and we still run our hub outside of OUSD, but we are now building and expanding the hub within OUSD, piloting six schools. We're in the process of hiring more family liaisons, like Heather said, like you guys are all saying, it's the secret sauce, right? So we're hiring more family liaisons, which actually creates more jobs. So like another component of the hub is around economic development. I mean, there's opportunities to reskill, right? And so we're hiring more literacy tutors because a huge focus of this expansion is literacy as well as family liaisons. And Ethan, the other thing I will add just to what Heather said is that you're going to have a set of kids who are going to be going back to school on a part-time basis. So they're going to have some learning in this hybrid model, right? Some learning online and some learning at home. But then what about all the families who just are opting out altogether? Who's going to serve them, right? And most of those families are like our families, right? So what we would like to see is we would like to see our model. You keep hearing me say hub, hub, hub. We've already figured out the model. All it needs to do is be replicated. We have the five components. It's coming straight from the voices of families. You don't need to figure it out. There's no guesswork. You just need to replicate it, right? And so that's exactly what we're focusing on with OUSD. Let's replicate and let's expand this model. And like Heather says, I'm going to make a connection. Let's get ahead of the game. What is not going to be acceptable is to hit August and people are scratching their heads and wondering what's happening and what's going on and we're not ready and we're not prepared. Guess who gets screwed? Our families are the ones. So we're talking about this right now in March. Is it still March? Okay, it's still March. You know, this runs together on your way home. We have the model. We need to have it replicated and we need to have it ready for the families that are choosing to stay at home even when the school year starts. So you should hear no excuses come August about our kids having access to a high quality education. It's not acceptable. We're not taking it anymore.
Well, so Lakeisha, I think that point is very well taken. Just last question for you. Post-pandemic, what role do you see the hub playing going forward? I mean, is this now kind of permanent reforms that you see in your mind that maybe the pandemic has helped inspire that might improve learning in the long term here?
We want this to be the new normal because you know what it does? It's very different. It's parent-led and parent-centered. You remember, you guys were probably doing a show on the pandemic pods last July. What was that? That was privilege. That was families with privilege saying, hey, we know this is going to be a hot mess. So we're going to just take our baby's education in our own hands, get some teachers, and we're going to roll with it. And guess what? I'm not mad at them. But our families need an infrastructure, funding, and support to do the same things. We want our families to be able to curate and design their own education. And the last thing I'll add, Ethan, is that one of the things we've been able to do through the hub that our families, 90% of our families ask for this, they want more curriculum. They want more teachers and more folks in front of their kids' faces that look like them. They want more curriculum that is steeped in their culture. And we've been able to do that in the hub. We don't have to fight and yell and scream around this stuff. We've just been able to deliver it. I think what people don't really understand is that we teach Black and brown low-income families to fight and struggle just to get a little bit or nothing at all. But with the hub, we just was able to deliver the things that they're fighting for. Who wants to give that up? We don't, and we're not.
Well, that's the porterhouse steak of the hub. And one last, in the 15 seconds we have, Heather, what's one thing a parent can do for a kid who's learning online to help them?
The most important thing is to make sure that your child, if they are struggling, has as much time for one-on-one interaction with the teacher or small groups as possible. Many schools and teachers have that ability, but you need to advocate for your child to make sure that they're getting what they need.
That is a great piece of advice.
All right. Well, we're going to have to close it there, but this has been a fantastic conversation. I want to thank our guest tonight, Lakeisha Young, co-founder and CEO of the Oakland Reach. Thanks so much for joining us, Lakeisha.
Thank you for having me.
And Heather Huff, Executive Director of Policy Analysis for California Education. Thanks so much, Heather.
Thank you so much.
Next up, our co-host Joseph Pache sits down with Dr. Linda Hsu to discuss her new book, Spicebox Kitchen. Stay with us.
Last week, Dr. Linda Hsu sat down with host Joseph Pache to talk about her new cookbook, Spicebox Kitchen. She's an internist, professionally trained chef, and director of culinary medicine here in San Francisco. Along with her clinical work, she teaches cooking classes to patients and colleagues designed to improve their health and wellness. In short, she is a champion of the notion that food can be healthful and delicious.
I'm so happy to welcome my friend and colleague, Dr. Linda Hsu, to State of the Bay. Hi, Joseph. Thank you so much for having me.
So the title of your upcoming book is Spice Box Kitchen. So tell us about a spice box. What is it and why is it significant to your book?
So a spice box is the English translation of the Indian masala dabba, which is basically a container that holds your most essential everyday spices so that you have access to them for everyday cooking. And the reason why that became the construct around my book is that I really believe in the power of spices for both flavor and interest in cooking and in their medicinal properties.
So what was your goal in writing this book and who is your intended audience?
My goal in writing this book was really to change the conversation about what healthy eating and healthy food is, right? To make people realize that it can and should be delicious and something fun to cook and that you really want to cook and eat. So my intended audience is, well, truly everybody. Truly the home cook, whether you have experience cooking or whether you're a novice, but who might be looking for some new ideas. And I think, you know, that's one of the upsides of the pandemic and the timing of my release is that a lot of us have been cooking more than ever, right? This past year in our home kitchens, and people might be looking for some new ideas. And so by bringing in spices, I'm hoping to allow people to travel from their own kitchens and bring some of the world into their homes.
So you went to medical school and years later to culinary school, and you're using your expertise in both of these areas in your professional life now. Were you always intending to mix the two, or did cooking and medicine start out as separate pursuits for you?
I actually was a cook before I was a doctor. So I grew up loving food, you know, from day one. I took my first cooking class when I was 7. It was a French cooking class and I made quiche. And then it literally was about 40 years later before I went to culinary school. All that time, I think I was pretty young when I decided that I would become a doctor, you know, probably from when I was in kindergarten. But I never thought that food was part of medicine, like a lot of people. I never realized that there was this essential connection and that I should and could share that with my patients. So that connection kind of went off as my light bulb moment about 10 years into my career as a primary care doctor. I went to a continuing medical education conference called Healthy Kitchens, Healthy Lives, which is held annually by the Culinary Institute of America and Harvard Medical School. And it's a conference where basically all the evidence and science around nutrition is reviewed, but also, and quite essentially, you learn how to cook and you eat this delicious food prepared by the CAA chefs. And I remember being at this conference, this is in 2012, and thinking, oh, this is what's missing. This is what's missing from my practice. I, at that time, was feeling a little bit burnt out, not inspired, and I felt like I wasn't really doing enough to inspire and empower my patients to improve their own health. And I thought, you know, I love to cook. I know how to cook. If I can actually take the next step of just telling patients that they had to improve their nutrition, but actually teach them how to do that in very simple, practical ways that were delicious, that might be the key. So literally a week after that conference, I taught my first cooking class to patients.
So did culinary medicine exist when you were in medical school? We were actually in medical school around the same time. I don't recall that. I did take a nutrition course in medical school, but I don't recall that it had a lot to do with how to counsel patients or how to teach them how to cook.
This is a great point, and I think it surprises a lot of people who are not in medicine that medical schools are only required to have about 24, 25 hours of nutrition training throughout the 4 years. That's almost nothing. And this was definitely true for me when I was in medical school. Probably like you, my nutrition course focused on, you know, the science, very basic science of like micronutrients and macronutrients and tube feeding formulas. Nothing that was about food. It actually did not talk about food at all, at all. And in fact, I will share, it's a little bit embarrassing. When I started as a primary care doctor after I finished residency, despite the excellent training that we both received, I had, you know, a healthy patient who asked me, oh, you know my cholesterol is pretty good. I want to get it even better. What do I eat? And I remember sitting there thinking, I don't know. I don't know what to tell you because I was never trained to do this. And this is a very common experience for most doctors.
So let's talk a little bit more about the structure of your book. You frame the book through the lens of your four cultural influences, as you mentioned them. Can you explain what those are and the thread between them?
Sure. So in Spicebox Kitchen, I intentionally wanted to highlight many different global cuisines. And the reason for that, I think, is to dispel another myth that there's kind of one monoculture of healthy food, which is North American cooking, what I like to call kale and quinoa wellness, you know. And while I love kale and quinoa, and those are important ingredients in the book as well, I think what that does to people who don't come from cultures who necessarily cook that way or have flavors that don't fit into that is make people realize that there is more than one way to eat healthy. I think that's really important to people. If we want to reach people in our very multicultural society, we have to teach them that there's a healthy way to cook that actually honors, respects, and celebrates those traditions. So I basically included four regions of the world and many countries within those regions that I have some connection to. So the first is California with some, Mexican-inspired dishes from, you know, where I've lived for the last 20 years. And then I move on to the many different countries in Asia where my heritage is from, in Taiwan and the countries that I've lived and traveled in. And then I move on to the Mediterranean. After culinary school, I staged at Mourad, which is a Michelin-starred Moroccan restaurant here in San Francisco, which is
fabulous.
I just
drove by there yesterday. That's so funny. Yeah.
Oh, did you? Yeah. I can't wait for it to reopen. But Moroccan food especially uses a lot of spices. So that it brings in my love of spices and the medicinal power of spices, which isn't emphasized on the menu there, but the spices are. And the Mediterranean diet is one of the healthiest diets that we know about in the world in terms of preventing and reversing chronic disease. So that was a very important section to include for that reason. And then finally, the last section is on Trinidad, which is a cuisine which is fabulous and multicultural and that many people don't know about and that I know about through my husband. And so I wanted to take those traditional flavors, highlight them for people who may be looking for something new and don't know about it, and actually make them a little bit healthier. My feeling is that a lot of the traditional cuisines of the world were actually largely plant-based, you know, where meat products were actually more of a condiment for a variety of reasons, and that much of the world has actually transitioned more to our modern industrial Western diet, and in so doing have become less healthy. But if we look at the roots of most traditional cuisines, they're plant-based. And so I thought this is a very genuine and authentic way of highlighting a lot of flavors around the world.
So in the book and in the title, of course, you're focusing on spices and you've mentioned a couple of times the health benefits of various mm-hmm. spices. If you could only use one spice, what would that be and why?
Oh, that's so unfair to restrict it to one spice, Joseph. But if I have to talk, I think if I have to address both of these issues of both flavor and what we know about health benefits, it would be turmeric. So one of the active components in turmeric is curcumin. And this is a powerful anti-inflammatory, and inflammation is what we know now is related to all of our chronic diseases. Not just, ooh, I have achy joints. It will help with that because it works very much like non-steroidal anti-inflammatories like ibuprofen. And so that will help people. But inflammation is important for all of our chronic diseases. So having some curcumin in your diet, turmeric in your diet, which would be a great idea, especially if it combined with freshly ground black pepper, it actually increases the bioavailability. And I think this is a fascinating point. People have cooked with that combination of spices, of turmeric and black pepper, for, you know, millennia in Indian cooking. And maybe people didn't talk about that for this particular health reason about increasing bioavailability. But this is the kind of folk wisdom that gets passed down and that, you know, people knew, maybe they didn't know why, that it was good for their health.
Well, Linda Hsu, thank you so, so much for joining us and for giving us such an interesting look into how food can become medicine with some simple changes to people's eating and cooking habits.
Thank you so much, Joseph. It's been great talking to you.
That was Joseph Pache's conversation with Dr. Linda Hsu about her new cookbook, Spicebox Kitchen. If you want to learn more about the book, go to State of the Bay page on KALW.org. And that's it for State of the Bay this week.
But next week, tuning in on Monday at 6 o'clock, as always, State of the Bay is going to be joint talking about the state of Oakland school reopening.
Welcome
with Mayor Libby Schaff, and also Dr. Allison Briscoe-Smith and Dr. Raylina Joseph about their new book, Generation Mixed Goes to School, Radically Listening to Multiracial Kids. We'll also hear about fun things to do during the pandemic. So join co-host Joseph Pache with me next Monday at 6 for those great guests and topics.
Our engineer this evening was D Minor, and tonight's show was produced by Chris Nooney, Kendra Klang, and Wendy Holcomb.
And for a link to this and other State of the Bay shows, visit our State of the Bay page on KALW.org. I'm Ethan Elkind.
And I'm Grace Wan. Have a
good night. And
oh, yeah, we're going to say it together. Have a great week.
Good night. Thanks for listening, all. Take care.
Bye.